ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
श्रीमद् भगवद् गीता एज इट इज Chapter 8, Text 21, Translation and Commentary by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Abhyakto shara ityuktastamahu paramam gatim yang prapyana nivartante tantama paramam nama. Lord Krishna said, that which the Vedantists describe as unmanifest and infallible, that which is known as the supreme destination, that place from which, having attained it, one never returns, that is my supreme abode. Purport. The supreme abode of the personality of Godhead, Krishna, is described in the Brahma Samhita as Chintamani Dham, a place where all desires are fulfilled. The supreme abode of Lord Krishna, known as Golok Vrindavan, is full of palaces made of touchstone. There are also trees called desire trees that supply any type of eatable upon demand. And there are cows, known as Surabhi cows, which supply a limitless supply of milk. In this abode, the Lord is served by hundreds of thousands of goddesses of fortune, Lakshmis, and He is called Govinda, the primal Lord and the cause of all causes. The Lord is accustomed to blow His flute, Venangvanantam. His transcendental form is the most attractive in all the worlds. His eyes are like lotus petals. And the color of His body is like the color of clouds. He is so attractive that His beauty excels that of thousands of cupids. He wears saffron cloth, a garland around His neck, and a peacock feather in His hair. In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna gives only a small hint of His personal abode, Golok Vrindavan, which is the supermost planet in the spiritual kingdom. A vivid description is given in the Brahma Samhita. Vedic literatures, Katha Upanishad, state that there is nothing superior to the abode of the Supreme Godhead, and that that abode is the ultimate destination. Purushana param kinchit sa kashta paramagatihi. When one attains to it, He never returns to the material world. Krishna's supreme abode and Krishna Himself are none different, being of the same quality. On this earth, Vrindavan, 90 miles southeast of Delhi, is a replica of that supreme Golok Vrindavan located in the spiritual sky. When Krishna descended on this earth, He sported on that particular tract of land known as Vrindavan, composing about 84 square miles in the district of Mathura, India. Here we are in Manipal, otherwise known as Little England. Little England, what does that mean? Well, let's think about it. Means that Western culture is predominant here, that's the idea, more than Indian culture. The Western culture is based on personal sense enjoyment, let us enjoy life. Whereas traditional Indian culture is based on sense control, with a higher aim of life. So this is Little England. It's supposed to be a little colony of sensual enjoyment, close to Udupi, which is one of the traditional places of spiritual culture. Within a country which was fully dedicated to spiritual culture, Udupi is one of the traditional centers of spiritual culture throughout this land. Of course, Little England is losing its specialness because the whole of India is becoming like a big England. It's all becoming dedicated to sense enjoyment. Actually, I come from, at least I was born this time round in England, the real England over there. But seeing the whole way of life is simply based on personal enjoyment, but no one's happy. In my youth, when I was younger than all of you students, I started thinking that, well, maybe there's something better than the way of life that's offered here. I didn't start thinking, well, maybe I should go to America, because America is more progressed than England in sense enjoyment. That going to America is not the solution. That's increasing the problem. If we think that we're going to increase our enjoyment, get more money, drink more booze, have more girlfriends or boyfriends, and then we'll be more happy, it's increasing the problem. So, definitely we need to go to a better place. We may think that I'll come to Little England and that is better than Udupi. Udupi is just boring, just, you know, going to a temple, boring. Whereas in Little England we can enjoy ourselves. So, Krishna's proposal here is, yeah, go to a better place. There's a better place than Little England, and that's Big England. If you go to the real England, it's still pretty cold. This is the summer here, but it's still winter in England, in the real England. Wait a minute, it's the end of May. It's just beginning to get a little bit warm. It might get above 20 some days. And there could be still snow. Still possible at this time of year. So, now it's the holiday season. So people are going from India to England and America. And people from England, they come to India. Because this is the summer here, but it's still winter in England. In the real England. Wait a minute, it's the end of May. It's just beginning to get a little bit warm. It might get above 20 some days. And there could be still snow. It's still possible at this time of year. So, now it's the holiday season. So people are going from India to England and America. And people from England, they come to India. Because people from Dakshin Kannada are going to Bombay, and people from Bombay are going to Dakshin Kannada, because everyone thinks it's better somewhere else. People from here are going to Bangalore, people from Bangalore are going here, like this. All the trains are full. Let me go somewhere else where it's better. Where you go somewhere else where it's better, you stay in a house, you rent someone's house, because they left to go to the place that you just came from. And actually, it's all miserable. This is something in the Western countries, they sometimes blame Vedic culture, that it's pessimistic, because it says that material life is miserable. Well, it's not pessimistic, it's just realistic. Material life is miserable. And the more you try to enjoy it, the more you suffer. That is the paradox of material life. The more you, just like here, the modern life, it's. I saw some advertisement in Bangalore. They were advertisement for some shirts, Peter England or Alan Solly or something like this. They have these English sounding names which we never heard of these companies in England. I think it's just made up in India. They pretend it's English or something like that. So the formula on the advertisement was work hard, party harder. So you work hard all week and then completely in the mode of passion, working hard. And instead of at the weekend relaxing, then just become more in the mode of passion and go to party. But the result is burn out. Become burned out. So actually it's a fact that material life doesn't bring any happiness, but this is not a pessimistic philosophy. If one, first point is it's not a pessimistic philosophy, it's not an opinion, it's a fact. Material life is miserable. As the Bhagavad Gita, in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna points out, material life revolves around four factors. Janma, mrityu, jara, vyadhi, dukkha. Dukkha anudarshanam. That material life means birth, death, old age and disease. It was okay. Why are you adjusting? Just leave it. This is a must in every lecture. It's like in material life there's birth, death, old age, disease and someone unnecessarily adjusting the sound system. These are the miseries of material life. So, actually they say work hard, party harder, but then so many people, they're working hard, they're partying harder, and then they suicide. Or they get carted off to there's some insane asylum in Bangalore, and most of the people are software professionals who, they can't take it anymore. They get stuck in the insane asylum. Or apart from that, there are so many diseases. Modern life, the most prominent causes of death, here we need Tejas Prabhu for that. You can give us the exact figures down to the exact number of how in modern life people, the main causes of death, here the doctors can tell you. What is it? Cancer, heart disease, these are all modern diseases. Of course, they may have been there previously, but they're much exacerbated by modern life. And a major cause of death is road accidents, especially people are driving drunk, and then, not surprisingly, they crash and kill themselves and kill others. So, and then you were saying that the major cause, what's it called? Aya something or other? Huh? Iatrogenic, that means he's a doctor. It means the doctor kills you. It means he may not mean to, but it was another case of the operation was successful, but the patient died. So there are so many diseases caused in modern life. We think that by medicine we're curing all the diseases, but actually by the laws of nature, new diseases come up. There was no AIDS previously. Or this bird flu. It's the nature of this material world that you can't. I remember as a child they were saying that we are conquering disease, but it's just, this is mythology. They talk about Hindu mythology, but it's scientific mythology that we shall conquer all disease. So actually it is, it's realistic. It's a fact that material life is miserable. And it seems pessimistic if we never read this verse from Bhagavad Gita that I just read out now. It seems pessimistic. And that's why we'll find in the Western countries, some of the great, the well-known philosophers and authors, so many of the well-known intellectuals, they're very pessimistic. They promote a very pessimistic worldview. I was just talking the other day in Salem. There was a Czech devotee, the most famous Czech author was Franz Kafka. So he wrote 3 books: The Castle, The Trial, and Metamorphosis. And all of them, if you read them, when you've finished about 10 pages, you just want to go and commit suicide because it's so depressing. It's an analysis of material life, and it's so depressing how there's no love in this material world, and it's all exploitation, and there's no freedom, and it's just miserable. So he's expertly depicted this in his novels. And there are other philosophers who see the absurdity in material life. And one of the most influential French, actually he was Algerian, philosophers, Camus, his Siddhanta was that there's no meaning to life, so the only question left is whether we should end it now by committing suicide or just wait until we die. That's the only question left, because life is meaningless. And eventually one night he was driving along and drove his car off the edge of a cliff, and that was his conclusion of his philosophy. So actually, if we examine the nature of this material world, it is meaningless. What is it? Everyone's just trying to get some pleasure, and it all ends in death. And what is the meaning? We're just so insignificant. Why should we bother about anything? There are some flies, they're born in the day, and they never see the next day. Their whole lifespan is finished before dawn the next day. They get born and they reproduce and they die. And that's their lifespan. And our lifespan isn't much more. We live a few days, we go to college, we get a degree, we become a big shot. Some of us, we earn lots of money and we drive around in a big car. So I'm driving a bigger car than you. I've got a bigger bungalow than you. And then we die. And then the person who wasn't a big shot, who was a little shot or a small shot, they also die. And their life is meaningless and your life is meaningless, and it's all meaningless. So what's it all about? It's all meaningless. But avyaktokshra ityuktas tamahu paramam gatim. There is something more. Krishna describes here in Bhagavad Gita, it's not all meaningless. Philosophically, if we analyze, there should be meaning in life, because the whole universe is ordered. You're all studying, supposed to be studying. In medicine you study the workings of the body and how to make it work better when it's not working properly. It's a very complex topic. That's why doctors are so puffed up, because they have to learn so much. And not everyone can be a doctor. Either you've got to be very intelligent or be a Christian or scheduled caste or something. That's the only way you can become a doctor. So they tend to be very proud. I'm a doctor. Once I was on a train a few years ago going from Bombay to Surat, and I was sitting next to a heart surgeon, and it didn't take him more than a few seconds before he let me know, I'm a heart surgeon. I save people's lives. So you have to study so many things. But then if you see the body is so complex, what to speak of the whole body, even a single cell in our body is extremely complex. When I was at school in biology class, they taught us that the cell in the human body, it's very soon scientists will be able to explain everything about cells. Now they made more research and they found that even the most simple cell in our body is far more complex than any modern city, and it'll take a few more years before they can explain everything. So even as the most simple cell is so complex that we can't say everything about it. Especially in materialistic science, they can't say everything about it. What impels the cells to act? What's the medical explanation? Why should the white blood cells attack some, what's the word they say, some foreign organism? Why should it do that? Why? What's their motive? Why does the body work to correct itself? Why do the bodily... Why? Why the doctor cannot actually cure? The doctor can only assist or make some adjustments which can help the body to cure itself. Isn't it? So what is the mechanism that makes the body want to cure itself? What is the motivation that makes a human being want to stay alive? So if we examine, there is some mechanism, some design, which means there's meaning. There must be some meaning behind it all, isn't it? This box, if you see it, if you don't know, you may ask, what's that for? You see, the first time you ever saw a microphone, you may ask, well, what's that for? You say, well, nothing special, it's just some piece of art or something like that. But no, it's been designed with a specific purpose. Someone with specific intelligence designed it with a specific purpose. So it's in this particular shape, and it has all the wires and transistors or whatever is inside it are put in a particular way to serve a particular purpose. So if we see in the universe there's so much order and design, there must be a purpose, there must be a meaning. And that is what Krishna describes in Bhagavad Gita. He describes that this world is dukhalayama shashvatam. It is certainly miserable and temporary. But parastasma tubhava yo vyakto vyaktat sanatanaha. This is the verse previous to this. Yasa sarveshu bhuteshu nashyatsu navinashyati. Apart from this material world, which is miserable, there is the spiritual world, which is not dukhalayama shashvatam, which is sanatan chinmay anandamay sukhalayam, sanatan dhamma. There is a place of bliss. That bliss does not come from drinking booze or drinking Pepsi or riding around on motorbikes. That is not bliss. That is foolishness. That is described in the Bhagavad Gita, this work hard, party harder. That is described in Bhagavad Gita as rajagun. That seems like happiness in the beginning. But in the end, we find it's just miserable. Whereas happiness in the mode of goodness, yattadagre vishami parinami mritopamam, it's just the opposite. In the beginning, it might seem very difficult. It might seem like poison. But in the end, it seems like nectar. So in Krishna consciousness, we tell, no more partying, no more booze, no more coffee or tea, and people think, oh, that's too much. But parināme, mito, in the end, we find it's like nectar. Because instead of trying to get happiness out of a bottle or a can of Pepsi or a love affair or whatever it may be, we come to a higher platform. On the platform of sense control, of sattva-guna, we can begin to experience reality beyond this material so-called happiness, material happiness consists of the interaction of the senses with the sense object. In other words, we see something, we think it's nice. We hear something, we think it's nice. We touch something. But this is only on the gross platform, which the animals are also enjoying. But the higher happiness is the spiritual happiness, which is beyond the platform of seeing, touching, smelling, feeling, tasting on the material platform, and engaging our senses in the service of Krishna, who is the super enjoyer on the transcendental platform. Transcendental platform means it's not the gross platform. It is not the gross platform of gross material desire, but that enjoyment of Krishna, Krishna's touching, tasting, smelling, feeling, hearing, thinking, it's all based on the platform of pure love for his devotees. So spiritual life doesn't mean negating everything. Spiritual life means learning how to love Krishna and please Krishna and interact with Krishna on this spiritual platform, beyond the platform of thinking, I want to enjoy myself, and simply acting to please Krishna. And by doing that, this is called bhakti yoga, by doing that, we become transferred to the spiritual world, where the whole activity, 24 hours a day, is neither work hard nor party harder, but play always. 24 hours a day, there's no real day as we think of it in material terms. It means in the spiritual world, it's always being with Krishna. And Krishna is enjoying with his devotees. And Krishna, just by seeing him, we become fully satisfied, because Krishna is so beautiful. And the beauty of Krishna never diminishes. The beauty of anyone in this material world, it comes and it goes. It's like a flower, which looks very nice today, and tomorrow it's all wilted. So in the same way, since I've been living in India, there's been the famous Bollywood film star, there's been Rekha, and then Sridevi, and Madhuri Dixit, and I don't know who it is now, I'm not really up with it all. I think there was Aishwarya Rai, and I think she's also finished now, more or less. So it just lasts a few days. And that beauty of the film stars, it's also skin deep. Miss World also releases, you know, half a kilo or so of stool every day. That's what the beauty is of this material world. But Krishna's beauty is of a different quality altogether. Krishna's beauty is ananda chinmaya rasa pratibhavitavihi. His beauty, his pastimes, they are of the quality of spiritual pleasure. He is shama sundaram achintya guna swarupam. His body is not made out of doctors. They can tell us what is the beauty of the body. All intestines and kidneys and stomach and glands and so many things. But Krishna's transcendental form is achintya guna swarupam. Krishna's transcendental form is composed of inconceivable transcendental qualities, and his beauty never diminishes. But that's not all. You could spend millions of years describing the beauty of Krishna and you'd never come to the end. But the beauty of Krishna is not everything that's to be known about him. He also has his wonderful pastimes and his wonderful playing on his flute and his wonderful devotees, and everything is beyond anything that we can imagine on this material platform. That's why it's called achintya. You may say, well, I went to a good party last night. We have some measurement of what we consider to be happiness. But 1 second of life in the spiritual world with Krishna is infinitely more pleasurable than millions of parties or whatever you may consider to be enjoyable in this material world. Because everything in this material world is mixed with the quality of incompleteness. Everything in this, what we perceive as pleasure in this material world is based on the misconception that I should be happy without Krishna. But actually we cannot be happy without Krishna. Because we are intrinsically, constitutionally, part and parcel of Krishna. So in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is pointing, there's another place. We're not meant to be here. We're not meant to be in Little England or in Mera Bharat Mahan, or we're not meant to be NRIs or English or Americans or pigs or dogs or cats or whatever situation we may get within this material world. We're simply meant to be with Krishna. That is our actual happy position. The jiva, every jiva wants to be happy. That is the nature of the jiva, because by nature the jiva is happy. Because the jiva is part and parcel of Krishna, who is ananda chinmaya rasa pratibhavita vihi. He is by nature full of happiness. His very nature is happiness. But in this material world, forgetting Krishna, we are trying to be happy without Krishna, which is impossible. It's not possible to be happy without Krishna. We can try, but it's something like trying to make rasgullas out of soya milk or something like that. It just, you can't make pera out of soya milk. You can make some kind of imitation, but it won't be the same. It's the difference between, well, it's a rough example. It's like the difference between dalda and ghee. Dalda can never be ghee. It might look the same, and the things you cook in it might look the same, but the taste can never be the same. So that's just a rough example, that actual life, as Krishna describes here in Bhagavad Gita, is with Him in His Sanatan Dharma. Krishna is the center of all existence, and the meaning of life in this material world is to find Krishna, to find what is our actual happy situation. A really intelligent person understands that there is no happiness in this material world, so there must be happiness somewhere else. Where is that place? How can I find that place? This information is given in Bhagavad Gita. It is not a sectarian religious book. It is not meant for converting people for some political motive. But it is Bhagavad Gita, if understood as Srila Prabhupada has presented it, as it is simply meant for the ultimate benefit of everyone who wants to receive it, as Arjuna has received it. Arjuna received it. How did Arjuna receive it? With submission. Shishastehang shadi mantram prapannam. Accepting what Krishna is saying. Sarvameta vritang manye yannam vadasi keshava. That what you say, Krishna, I accept. Arjuna wasn't a fool. He was much more intelligent than all of us. We might think, I'm very intelligent. I'm a doctor, this, that. But actually, we might think modern society is very advanced and very progressive, but actually previously people were much more intelligent than they are nowadays. In every village, there used to be Sanskrit pundits who could discuss Vedanta philosophy. Here in this verse, Krishna is speaking. Tamahu, they say, who is they? The Vedantists. But nowadays people don't have the brains to study Sanskrit. And they can't understand this philosophy. And if someone comes along and speaks one or two words of Sanskrit, they think, oh, very big pundit. But actually, previously, the standard of education was much higher. It wasn't so widespread. It wasn't that everyone was educated, but those who were educated, their education was much better. One reason is because they didn't go to parties. They studied. They learned from the acharyas how to control the mind. So many people come and say, I can't concentrate on my studies. How can you concentrate when there are so many distractions? So education should actually be conducted in an atmosphere of sattva-gun. Previously, the educational institutions were under trees in the forest. That was they say, Manipal, we have all facilities. But previously, the facility was you study under a tree. That was the facility. Very good. Sattvic environment for cultivating sattvic knowledge, knowledge of the soul. But to study in Rajagun, you need big buildings, big facilities. But then the knowledge you get, that's also only Rajasic. The knowledge of Rajagun binds us to this material world and makes us think that this material world is a reality and this is all in all. It's the education, it's educating us to become like asses. Asses means they carry a heavy weight which is of no value to them. Another thing about an ass is that he can only see just a little bit in front of him. An ass doesn't have long range. You don't put an ass on a planning commission. Because, actually the planning commissions are full of asses, but they're full of asses because planning commission means they only see 5 years, 10 years, or they may even, ecologists, they may say, well, we have to see the future, the next 1,000, 2,000 years of the human race. But they only see society in terms of the ecosphere, in terms of the bodies inhabiting it. They don't understand that after death, there is life. That beyond this material world, there is life. They say, is there life on Mars? Is there life beyond Earth? Certainly, there's the whole spiritual world is full of life. This is the world of death. Where we are living is the world of death. There isn't actual life is in the spiritual world. So one who's very intelligent, he can see these things. In the modern age, it's very difficult to be intelligent because the whole educational system fools us into thinking that we're intelligent by accumulating some facts and figures in our brains and having some ability to juggle them up in our brains and interpret them. But that's not real intelligence. Real intelligence means to see what is the highest purpose of life. And if in the educational system they encourage you work hard, party harder, then they're educating you to be a fool. That's all. It's not actual education. Real education means to see what is the highest, what is the actual purpose of life? What is there beyond this working hard, making money, getting a reputation, and dying? What is there beyond this? So Krishna is giving this knowledge. Avyaktoksha ityuktas tamahu paramam gatim. Beyond this material world, there is the spiritual world. There is the world of Krishna. That is reality. We can begin to perceive that by purification of consciousness, which comes by chanting the holy names of Krishna and studying Bhagavad Gita as it is. So, there's not much more time before the arati. Actually, when there's arati, everyone runs and sees. But actually, it's more important to hear. By seeing, without hearing, you'll just see a statue. By hearing, you'll understand who Krishna is. But anyway, temples are made for people to come and see, because people are, they don't have much transcendental discrimination. When we hear, then we can actually see. If we just see, we'll see nice statue. If we hear, then we can begin to understand who is Krishna. So anyway, the aarti is about to begin. So if there are any questions, please ask.
You mentioned that everyone is looking for happiness, and no one can be happy without Krishna. Mm. And it is stated that that place, Goloka Vrindavan, is where one never returns back from. Yet, we come under the category of those who have returned. Mm. Then, what are the conditions where we even think of enjoying separately from Krishna when we're already there and we realize that without Krishna there's no happiness? And under what conditions are we even imagining that we should enjoy separately?
The perennial question. How is it that the jeev who is part and parcel of Krishna has chosen to become separate from Krishna? Well, it's practically inconceivable, but at the same time we have to understand that we are given minute independence to choose to serve Krishna or not. Without that independence, there's no love. If we're simply programmed, you can program, you can make a robot that, probably you can make a robot that is programmed that the first time it sees you every morning, it says, "Honey, I love you." But it's a robot. It doesn't love you. Or you can even get servants who praise you. But actually they hate you. But they praise you because they're getting money. So love has to come from the heart, and that means voluntarily loving. So that there is independence to choose to serve Krishna or not presupposes that some will misuse it. Why we should do so? That doesn't make any sense. But that we are here is evidence. And that if there wasn't that choice, then there wouldn't be any love, because love comes from one's own volition, not by force. Kindly don't place the shastra on the ground. If you could kindly keep it up a bit, that would be better. To understand this simply by logic may not be possible, because it's illogical that we should misuse our choice. But that's the meaning of tatastha shakti. You can go one way or the other. Philosophically, the only other alternative is that Krishna placed us here, which would mean that Krishna was unfair. It's our fault that we're here. It's not Krishna's fault. All right. Well, more questions can come after the arati. Please avail of the books which are available here. Please read these books. Who's reading Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad? It looks like you're reading it very carefully. You're reading it a lot, huh? You're also, there's a new, or you're reading regularly. Yeah. Why don't you get the, I think there's no Sanskrit shlokas. Why don't you get with the Sanskrit shlokas? Sorry? Is it? All right. But you can go deeper with the Sanskrit shloka.
Yes, sir?
Maharaj, so then it's never guaranteed that if we go, we may not fall back. There's always a fear that we may also fall back.
Well, if you want, you don't have, you can come back. Hare Krishna. The jiva always has independence. Jiva never becomes a robot. But yadgatvana nivartante, one doesn't fall away. That's the general understanding.
Oh. there is material intelligence. Is there a difference between that and spiritual intelligence?
Yes, of course.
So whatever we acquire...
Material intelligence means intelligence applied in the futile endeavor to enjoy this material world. Spiritual intelligence begins by seeing that endeavors to enjoy this material world are futile, and therefore applying our intelligence to understand what is the nature of the spiritual world. Material intelligence works on the wrong assumption. The sound is not high enough. Oh, I see. Material intelligence works on the assumption that I can work everything out by myself. So it's applied for the wrong purposes and with the wrong attitude. And spiritual intelligence means intelligence applied how to understand the highest reality, and with the understanding that my own intelligence is limited, and that only if my intelligence is guided by the higher intelligence, who is Krishna, can I actually understand anything. So both the motivation and the attitude are quite different in material intelligence and spiritual intelligence. That's why we see that many people who are materially very intelligent are spiritually very foolish. They may be very brilliant materially, but when it comes to they have come up with so many stupid ideas that there is no such thing as spiritual life, or then they everything is God is dead, or so many stupid things they come up with. Whereas often it may be that someone who's materially not very accomplished or intelligent is spiritually brilliant, because they understand, I'm the servant of Krishna, everything here is temporary. This material world is not my real place. I belong to Krishna. So such a person, if he understands that, then he may not be materially very intelligent, but his intelligence is actually far more advanced than someone who's brilliant materially, but doesn't understand this. So real intelligence means to come to the right conclusion. By jugglery, by algebraic jugglery, you can prove that 1 equals 0. But it's wrong. 1 plus 1 equals 2. If you say that, then you're correct. You may be brilliant at algebra, but if you're useless in arithmetic, then you'll get everything wrong. You may really be brilliant in calculus, but because you never learn your multiplication tables properly. They still learn multiplication tables at school? They still do. I thought it's all done by finger work these days. So if you learn that 7 times 7 equals 37, then you might be brilliant in mathematical theory, but all your... You'll fail everything because you got it wrong. So that's... In material life, one may be very brilliant materially, but there are some basic mistakes by which they get everything wrong. You're listening to what is going on, or you're chanting japa, or what are you doing? You can't do both. There's a time and a place for everything. If you want to listen here, you can't listen to your japa at the same time. Yeah, more questions. You're becoming spiritually intelligent. No, you shouldn't be sorry. We should be sorry if we don't have questions.
So we are always cultivating spiritual knowledge then?
Are we? We hope so. Mostly people aren't.
So then...
Mostly people are not cultivating spiritual knowledge.
If it's separate. In the subtle body, that intelligence is the material intelligence then. In the subtle body, the mind intelligence.
When we say subtle body, we mean the mind intelligence and false ego, which are, they're all produced of the false ego of thinking that I am separate from Krishna. Spiritual intelligence is an attribute of the soul, not of the false ego. Mundane intelligence is an attribute of the false ego. Real intelligence or spiritual intelligence is an attribute of the soul.
But that soul, later he might even remember that in my past life I was so and so. So then, how is that? Now, there are some.
You mean that we have not, as long as we're in this material world, we have knowledge of it?
No, of our past lives, that I remember in this lifetime I was this, and yeah. I had so and so.
Yeah,
so that intelligence, that memory is retained. How, if the subtle body, my question is that.
That if someone remembers something from a previous life, that's because of Paramatma. Sarvasya cha ham hridi sannivishto matasmritya jnanam apohanam cha. The Paramatma is with us. The Paramatma knows everything that we ever did, and he may give us knowledge of a previous life. He may award that to us, although it's not actually very, it's not particularly meaningful to have knowledge of previous lives. Sometimes people, they go for hypnotic regression, but what does it matter? What is it? In our previous life we were in Maya, and in the present life we're in Maya, so we should get out of Maya by chanting Hare Krishna. It doesn't matter whether you were a king or a pujari or a dog or whatever in your previous life. That we had a previous life, that's there, but what does it matter what we were doing?
To explain to others that there is life after death, we have to say that, okay, people have these past experiences.
That may be. Sometimes there are people who have done studies with hypnotic regression and this and that. It's not absolutely required for preaching, but it can be employed, but it's not important to us as individuals what we were doing in our previous life. What are we doing with this life? That's a lot more important.
Is it appropriate to say that at every life, at every birth, we acquire a separate sattva body? Is it appropriate to say that?
No, that the sattva body, the subtle body goes with us. The gross body dies, but the subtle body goes with us, and that undergoes transformations. The basic impetus is there, but the subtle body, when we're in the body of a goat, gross body, then the false ego is thinking conditions us to think I am a goat. So it's always undergoing transformations. That's how we get different bodies. The gross body we get forms according to the consciousness of our subtle body. Yang yang vapi swaram bhavam tyajante kalevaram tam tam e vaite kontaya sada tad bhava bhavitaha. According to our thoughts and attitudes at the time of death, it's all stored up and it all becomes manifest at the time of death. And then we get another gross body based on our subtle body. That's why you see in the Western countries, it's quite noticeable. Someone has a dog and their face starts to look like their dog's face because they're attached to their dog. And they're actually, the gross body starts to alter according to their subtle body. They're preparing themselves to take birth as a dog or a horse. You see, people keep horses and they start to look like a horse. I remember seeing one man, he was selling fried chicken, old man, looked like he would die at any time. He looked just like, his face looked just like a chicken. There's this Kentucky Fried Chicken, Colonel Sanders, his face, it looks like a chicken, and that's his business, and that was his business. And because of that, when you're eating Kentucky Fried Chicken, you might be eating Colonel Sanders. Because he must be taking birth as a chicken again and again. The subtle body forms. That's why, according to one's consciousness, one gets the next body. That's why devotees in Krishna consciousness, even they may not have very physically beautiful bodily features, but they actually look much nicer than non-devotees because their consciousness is pure. Whereas you see they have all these models, beautiful men and women, but actually devotees see they don't look very nice. They look dirty. Their consciousness is covered by rajagun and tamagun, by lust and greed. So they don't look very beautiful. The beauty of film stars and models, that is the beauty of mundane lust and greed. That is not actually beautiful. Devotees appreciate, they see Prabhupada, he looks so beautiful. Who would call an old man beautiful? An old man's body is not beautiful, but Prabhupada looks so beautiful because he's beautiful with pure Krishna consciousness. Yeah, please. You want to give the mic?
In the first chapter, the 40th passage, it is written, when irreligion is prominent in the family, O Krishna, the women of the family become polluted and form the degradation of womanhood. In the explanation, it's written, according to Chanakya Pandita, women are generally not very intelligent and therefore not trustworthy.
Hmm.
I couldn't quite understand the explanation of it.
Yeah, many people have a problem with that, especially people in women's bodies. The reason for this is that, and this is the Vedic explanation, and apparently it's also borne out by modern psychological studies, is that women tend to be propelled more by emotions. They tend to be, you know this man, what is that, men are from Mars, women from Venus, there's some famous book. So that the intelligence that comes with a woman's body tends to be more propelled by the emotions rather than what in Western understanding would be called rational judgment. So that also has its advantages because women are much better at looking after children than men are because they can relate to them because children are a bag of emotions. Children don't think rationally. So, but because of that, they're considered less intelligent in making rational decisions because they tend to be ruled by their emotions. And also because of that overly emotional side, they may, especially if they're not trained, as every human being, man or woman, is supposed to be trained in dharma, dharmic culture, then if one is acting on the platform of emotions without higher cultural training, then it's a very bad combination, which is very prominent in the world at the present time in both men and women, that people are not trustworthy because they're simply acting out of what they think is best for my sense gratification. So that's not condemnation. It's not a blanket condemnation. Women have the most important role in society as mothers. That's why women are called the first guru in Vedic culture. Because in the modern age, there's this idea that women should have careers and they should be as good or better than men. But with the body comes a different psychology and a different duty. And by nature's arrangement, women give birth to children, men don't. So, looking after children is an extremely important function, because if children don't receive their mother's love, which is only possible if they have this very sentimental, emotional nature, because if you're very rational, then what do I want to hand look after this thing? It's passing stool all over me all the time. And it's just screaming all the time. So that rationalness or can be hard-heartedness also, whereas women are by nature very soft-hearted. So that is the function given with, that is the function given by nature, ultimately by God, with the women's body. So that is, by following that Stri Dharma, women can be fulfilled in a manner which they can never be if they try to imitate men in the foolishness of men in the modern age of also trying to dominate the world. Rather, the whole society is misguided by everyone is trying to be a big enjoyer and dominate and be number one. So women are also joining that. But actually the result is that women in the modern age don't make good mothers because they have other priorities. A woman's life is meant for being one of sacrifice, for looking after their children and their families and the elders of society. But in modern life, the elders are neglected, the children are neglected, and the children being from young age, they don't get any love, so they don't love anyone, and then they grow up as rascals, and the syndrome just perpetuates itself. So that statement, if it's just taken without some explanation, has been and continues to be very shocking. But actually, if we understand the context, it's a fact. And the most intelligent women I know all admit that actually, in this regard, women are less intelligent in matters of judgment because they tend to be ruled by their emotions. Nowadays, of course, men also is because no one's cultivating sattva-gun. Everyone's cultivating rajagun and tamagun. That's why everyone is supposed to approach a guru who's supposed to be in sattva-gun, who can give clear indications of how to live our lives in such a way that we may be spiritually benefited. But certainly the traditional Vedic culture, you see, in the modern age there's what's called feminism, which says that women have been exploited by men. They couldn't fulfill themselves. They couldn't have the same opportunities. But the whole idea of having an opportunity in the material world is a foolish idea anyway. To become a big shot in this material world, that's a foolish idea. Rather, one should live his life in such understanding that I'm insignificant. We're all meant to serve Krishna and get out of this material world. And this idea of being ambitious and being very great and being very big. Rather, traditionally women have been the unsung heroes, or sung by their own children, of being the mothers of families. I have that book there, Glimpses of Traditional Indian Life. It's described that every man in Bangladesh, he keeps in his wallet a picture of his mother. So, Matri Bhakti, because they appreciate so much how the mothers have sacrificed everything for them. So women actually feel fulfilled like that, and they're respected and cared for in their old age. But nowadays, people don't care. Old people are just a burden. They have nothing to offer because they've never cultivated any higher values. Women are the first guru. That means in practical things, they teach you how to behave, and they also teach from the Ram Leela, Krishna Leela. They tell all you things. So in this way, they themselves become very deep spiritually. But in the modern age, everyone, they don't have spiritual life. They just sit in front of the TV. So they have nothing to offer in their old age. And no one wants to look after them either, because the parents didn't care so much for their children. And so the children don't care for much for them, and the whole society becomes horrible. So it's a big topic. Sorry, can you speak in the mic? I couldn't hear you.
Hinduism as such, or Krishna's teaching as such, are associating me with India. I wish to know, why didn't he manifest in other parts of the world?
Well, he is nowadays.
Yes, but...
Different people are born in different situations according to their karma and according to their spiritual development. If you're now in a situation by which you are to enjoy life greatly, then you go to Swarga Loka. If due to your desires and activities you're very musically inclined, then you may be born in Gandharva Loka. So different people are put in different situations to manifest the qualities they have and the desires that they have. So generally people are born in Bharata Varsha who have come to a certain level of spiritual development. And this is a land of spiritual culture where people who are at similar levels of spiritual development can help each other to go up more and more. You may say, why so many people come to Manipal to study medicine? Because the facility is here. So, and then visiting professors come also. And the professors come here because this is a place for teaching medicine. So Bharat Varsha is a place where generally souls who have cultivated piety in previous lives, by the arrangement of Bhagawan through the bhautik prakriti, they are put in this place, and Bhagawan himself comes here because this is a place which is particularly favorable for spiritual culture, where he will, the visiting professor doesn't have to come to Manipal. He can go to Mudabidri also. But in Mudabidri, there won't be so much use for him there, for his particular talents. He has to come to the place where people can appreciate. You know Mudabidri, it's a little up the line. So, Bhagawan comes traditionally to Bharata Varsha because this is a place where people can appreciate his coming and take advantage of that. That's why. Now he's all over the world by the grace of Srila Prabhupada. Another question.
Maharaj, can I add a comment to this question about why Krishna only comes to India?
Yeah.
Maharaj, my father was saying that when he travels, like for example in Sweden, he saw that the original natives, they used to, what do you call it, paganism?
Paganism.
Paganism.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
So he's saying that originally...
Originally the Vedic culture was spread all over the world. Yes. There seems to be plenty of evidence of that.
Yes, that's what
and the when Christianity bludgeoned its way into power about 1700 years ago in Europe, they attempted to destroy all traces of Vedic culture all over the world. And even nowadays it's common that there are archaeological findings of Ganesh deities, Vishnu deities all over the world, but it's all covered up. They don't like to, there's a kind of unspoken conspiracy all over the world to keep the worldview which is propagated by Western academia that there were apes, and then they, by genetic mutation, they became human beings, and then the pinnacle of human civilization which has developed is in the Western world. There's a kind of unspoken conspiracy to perpetuate this. And that, in this, actually according to anthropologists, the level of development of a civilization can be understood to a large degree by its language. So the Sanskrit language is by far the most developed language in the world, and it's ancient. But they like to say that actually the ancient Indian civilization, it was just all cavemen and Ajanta caves, and that was the height of it. And there's also all over the world an unspoken conspiracy, which the Indians are also, the educated Indians are gladly part of, to show that Indian culture is backward. In the Western press, when there's a riot in India, they make a big, big thing to show, just see how backward, but they have riots in the West also. they have racial violence, and what to speak of riots, they have they have wholesale wars. They invade countries on the pretext of humanitarianism. They invaded Iraq because they want to control the oil, but in the name of humanitarianism and democracy and so many things. So it's all a big hoax, actually. All they teach you, there's so many untruths which they project as truth, and if you say anything against it, they say, oh, you're crazy or you're fanatic, and they try to put this point. If you say that women are less intelligent than men, then immediately you'll get 50 million academics coming down, oh, you just want to exploit women. But actually the Vedic culture was protective of women. They say women should have equal freedom and this and that. And then they complain why women are being raped. Well, what do you expect? If the women are walking around drunk at 11 o'clock at night because they're free to do what they like, then what do you expect? The men are also drunk. Obviously, there's you have in the cinema pictures, all women in a very lusty pose, and then you encourage them to be like that, and the men to be like that, and then you complain that there's rape. Isn't it ridiculous? You're encouraging it, and the women are dressing in such a way to say, "I'm available, come and enjoy." And then they complain, why is there rape? So the Vedic culture didn't give, or actually not only Vedic culture, all cultures, they didn't give so much freedom, because there has to be protection. If women are thrown in the street, and then, they're joking with the young men, and there's going to be, what do you expect? So the Vedic culture protected the chastity of women, which is more important than their freedom. Because if there's no chastity, then children are just born as a result of lust. So maintaining the chastity of women is very important. So there's different values. In modern society, they think everyone should have freedom to do whatever they like. But that's not a very high level of civilization. Rather, we should understand what the purpose of life is and order society in such a way that people act instead of saying people should act in a manner in the way they like, rather society should be organized in such a way, in a manner that is beneficial for people. Do what you like, that's dog philosophy, actually. The dog has freedom to do what he likes. So the idea that we should have as much freedom to do as we like, it's not, they think this is wonderful, this is very progressive, but it's not. It means that we are becoming closer to the dogs and the pigs, actually. So in human society, restrictions should be there. But those restrictions are meant for the organization of human society for a higher ideal. And women may be very free in the modern age, but they have more anxiety. They can't depend upon their husband, because there's no... That's why they say, I have to get an education, because even after marriage, the husband may leave me, because there's no sense of duty or responsibility. Everyone just does what they like. And so in the marriage, the husband can't be neither husband nor wife. It's not a real commitment. There's no sense of duty. So it's just become, in the name of progress, everyone's just for themselves. So at least previously, women in the Previously, they had a fixed husband who would make an endeavor to look after them. And even in the roughest of times, men, husband and wife would stay together. There was no divorce. And women were respected. Nowadays, women are just sense objects. How to use them, that's all. For sense enjoyment. So what's better? To be exploited by one man, or to be exploited by every man? That's your freedom. But actually the exploitation comes when there's no higher aim of life. When there's no higher aim of life, then whatever system you have, it'll just decay anyway. But the Vedic culture was based on a higher aim of life. The sound system, is it working or what? Yeah.
It's a very paradoxical phenomenon. What one thinks, when it comes to action, it becomes totally different. As a immediate corollary for this question is, what decides what? Is it one's fate or is it one's nature?
We choose something and we expect there'll be one result and there's another one, another result. Well, that just goes to prove that we are not the controller. That is the illusion of material life. We think, I am the controller, but we are not the controller.
Then what is the role of our purushartha, as it says? Our purushartha, our will. There's something called free will, we accept it. But as an individual, what we
man
can
man proposes and God disposes. We can try, but the result is not in our hands. There's all these books nowadays that make yourself a success, but you cannot make yourself a success. If it's there in our destiny from what we've done in a previous life, we can be a success. Otherwise, anyway, what they call being a success, it's all nonsense anyway. But the role of destiny, that means what's destined for us by our previous activities, that also has a major role. Practically speaking, all the ideas in modern society, they're just, we think that it's for our benefit, but actually it's, we're just being exploited. We don't know what the real goal of life is.
In the 17th chapter, Krishna talks about faith, one's faith and one's nature. My question is, what decides what? Is it one's faith that decides one's nature?
It's an ongoing process, both influence the other. That one acquires a certain faith due to association. Sangat sanjayate kamaha. When we say swabhav, dehinam sa swabhavaja. Trividha bhavati shraddha, dehinam sa swabhavaja. In this, Krishna opens his words in this chapter by saying there are three basic divisions of faith. Sattviki, Rajasi, Chaiva, Tamasi. Sattvik, Rajasik and Tamasik. So swabhav here doesn't mean atma swabhav as the Madhvas misinterpret. It means the swabhav that we have acquired due to association with the modes of material nature in previous lives. We have a certain kind of swabhav that we have in this life. But that can also be changed by association. It's not fixed. That's why we're enjoined to take satsanga. By satsanga, we can come to a higher platform. We can rise. The whole subject matter of Bhagavad Gita is to rise above the three modes of material nature. So we can do so by associating with those who are on a higher level. So we have a certain kind of, here the word shraddha, that also means one's kind of inclination. One's inclination towards a certain kind of world view. Or a certain kind of mentality. So faith here means what in English would be called worldview, or the in philosophy they use the German word Weltanschauung. It means worldview. So here the simple term used here is shraddha. So that means one's outlook on life. But Krishna's whole teaching in Bhagavad Gita is how to go beyond the three modes of material nature. Mangchayo vyabhicharena bhakti yogena sevate sagunan samatityaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. The brahma bhuta platform, the spiritual platform, is beyond the three modes of material nature. So we have a certain kind of swabhav. We're born with that. And according to the association we have, we tend to, one of sattvic disposition, he tends to associate with others of sattvic disposition. So that becomes reinforced. But we have to go beyond even sattva-guna to shuddha sattva. That is possible by bhakti yoga.
Maharaj, you told about destiny. But what about our karma which we are doing? Like if everything is destined, then...
It's a common, silly question. If everything is destined, how did that destiny come? According to our karma. So that means there's choice. So within destiny there's choice also. It's destiny doesn't mean that everything is absolutely fixed. But we have a certain kind of situation within which we have some leeway. We have some room to move also. Just like in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna speaks of the yoga brashta, one who is performing yoga. By yoga here, Krishna doesn't mean exercise. They're advertising, get free of stress by doing Raja Yoga. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about spiritual cultivation. So one who does not complete the course, then in his next life, Shuchinam Srimatam Gehe Yoga Prashto Bijayati. He takes birth in the home of wealthy, pious people, or in the home of brahmanas who are dedicated to spiritual cultivation. So in other words, he gets born in a situation which is favorable for cultivating that spiritual consciousness. But he may misuse it also. That's also possible. It's not that you're forced. It's not that if one is born in a pious family that he doesn't have any choice. He will tend to be pious also, but he may misuse it. The example is there. There are so many examples. The example is there of Ajamil, who was born in a pious family due to his previous pious deeds. Not complete piety, otherwise he wouldn't have been born in this material world. Everyone is born in this material world, Ichha Dvesha Samuttena Dvandva Mohena Bharata Sarva Bhutani Sangmoham Sarga Yanti Parantapa. Due to material desires and envy of Krishna, we are born in this material world. So even if one is born in a very pious family, these faults are still there. And that it may not be very apparent, it may be subtle, as in the case of Ajamil, but by accidental association with persons in the lower modes of nature, he became attracted to that and he fell down. He chose to fall down, and even his parents and other people were telling him, don't do this, but his intelligence became covered by lust. So, we have the choice also. Destiny doesn't mean it's completely fixed. An example is sometimes given that you can get on a plane. So if you're on the plane, say it's going from Mangalore to Delhi, then you're on the plane and that's it. And until it reaches Delhi, there's nothing much you can do. That's fixed, that you're on the plane. But what you do on the plane, you can sleep, you can read the newspaper, you can talk to the person next to you. You have a choice of things to do on the plane. But that you're on the plane, that's fixed. So the broader things may be fixed, but then what you do within that situation, that you have some choice. And according to what you do, then you take your next birth. You fix your next destiny. Yeah.
Maharaj, you said that. Maharaj, is it okay to... Maybe we should not disregard everything that, okay, your bhiksha, okay, you know, that is not important.
Sorry, what's the question?
I'm getting to that. What I'm saying is that why can we not just change the consciousness and yes, become Vikshats, but utilize that potential?
You can try. But to become a big shot, you really have to concentrate. It's not just by twiddling your thumbs. You have to put your life and soul and energy into it. So the tendency is to be overwhelmed, and you have to associate with people like that also. So to cultivate Krishna consciousness, you require time for sadhana. You require time for hearing and chanting about Krishna. Whereas if you want to be a big shot in this material world, it takes up all your time. You have to really try hard. And also, if you are cultivating Krishna consciousness, you see what's the charm, what's the big thing about becoming a so-called big shot? What's the value? You might be, just as, who said that? Some men are born great, some men become great, and some have greatness thrust upon them. You might apparently by chance become big, but the endeavor to become big in this world takes up all the time and attention of one who's trying to do so. Whereas the human life is meant for understanding Krishna. So where's the time? If you're working, where's the time for chanting Hare Krishna? And if you are chanting Hare Krishna, actually, if you're experiencing Krishna Bhakti Ras, then you don't care very much for being a big shot. And actually, you don't want to associate with all these pseudo people who are big shots, who are just interested in name, fame, position. And yes, well, I was speaking with the Prime Minister the other day, and he's my best friend, by the way, and dropping names, and they have to have the latest, most expensive car, and just in very shallow consciousness, just like children like to show off my new toy. So they like to show, I've got the best car, I'm better than you. It's childish consciousness. So one who's cultivating Krishna consciousness, he's not interested in these things. So the two things don't go together very well. Trying to become materially big and trying to become spiritually advanced, because to become spiritually advanced means to understand Trinadapi Sunichena, to cultivate the understanding that I'm very small. If you do become very big in the material world, yes, you could maybe use it for preaching. You could do. But by the endeavor to do so, you'll probably kill whatever Krishna consciousness you have. So better to be satisfied in whatever situation you can easily live in this material world and cultivate Krishna consciousness. Yeah, you're not satisfied. You want to argue the point more. All right. What's your proposal?
My aim would be to serve my Guru Maharaj, and I thought that by doing that, because everyone can renounce and everyone can help in book distribution and, you know, like that, be in the temple. But I thought, okay, how can you make it big? How to spread Krishna consciousness in a big way?
The best way is you become Krishna. The best thing you can do to spread Krishna consciousness is to become Krishna conscious.
Yes.
And that you can do best by hearing and chanting about Krishna and serving Krishna. That is the best way to spread Krishna consciousness. First of all, you be Krishna conscious. You cannot spread Krishna consciousness by material consciousness. By cultivating material consciousness, you cannot inspire anyone else to be Krishna conscious. You might inspire them to be a kind of half Krishna conscious pious materialist, but that's not Krishna consciousness. You might inspire someone to be like you, someone who's practicing some form of Krishna consciousness while their main energy is in how to be a material success. So that way you might make more and more, you might convince more and more materially successful people to be partially Krishna conscious. But that's not Krishna consciousness. There's a question here, how Atma merges into Paramatma? Who asked this question? Well, The Atma is called Vibhinansha. Different is Ansh of Paramatma. And Vibhinansha, different from. So there's no question of complete merging. But by Bhakti Bhavana, one can merge into transcendental bliss of serving Bhagavan. But there's no question of becoming Bhagavan or merging and forgetting. One's identity is the servant of Bhagavan. So service means there's different identity. When one fully identifies himself as the servant of Krishna, then he merges into the spiritual nature. But full merging means no service. So this idea of merging is actually, that actually comes from envy of Krishna, that I don't want to serve Krishna. You say not everyone can become fully renounced, but actually, if we are to become Krishna conscious, then that has to be our aim to be. If we say, well, my aim is to be partially Krishna, I cannot become fully Krishna conscious, but then that's not true. The philosophy of Bhagavad Gita is that we are meant to be fully Krishna conscious. So we should aim at being fully Krishna conscious, not being partially Krishna conscious and at the same time cultivating material desires. Now that doesn't mean that everyone has to take sannyas immediately. There has to be some program for allowing people to indulge at some level. But that level is, that's always recommended. Devotees should live simply and not recognize that we have material desires and accommodate them, but don't encourage them. We should rather live in a, we should organize our lives in a manner that we can cultivate Krishna bhakti, not cultivate material desires and call it bhakti. That's something else. Do you want to speak in the mic? Well, I prefer you would, because then everyone else can hear it.
Maharaj, I wasn't saying that we cultivate material.
Well, you're saying you become a big shot in the material world.
No, but I meant
but to do that, you have to cultivate material desires.
But I meant.
And if you're so free of material desires that you can cultivate the desire to be a big shot in the material world, but you're saying, well, we're not free. You're saying we're not free of material desires. We're not fully renounced. That means you have material desires. So the point is too that we should act in such a way that we don't cultivate them more and more. Whereas you're proposing that yes, I'll become a big shot. That means to cultivate the material desires.
I'm proposing to add Krishna to your life. There's a statement.
Yes, but add Krishna to your life, not by add Krishna to your life, not add more material desires to your life. Add Krishna to your life doesn't mean that you also add more and more material desires. It means to add Krishna. That means to spend time to center your life around hearing and chanting about Krishna. Not to center your life around trying to be a material success and adding a little Krishna consciousness wherever you can. That's not what is meant by adding Krishna to your life. You can do like that. I mean, it's better than being a, if you have the idea, I'll be a big shot in this material world and also chant Hare Krishna. You can do that if you like. It's better than saying, you know, I'll be a meat-eating rakshasa. That's better. But it's a kind of self-deception because it's, you're more likely to end up just forgetting about Krishna consciousness, as many people who take to Krishna consciousness do, because they're not following the process given by Rupa Goswami, which is to, or by, given by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, to put Krishna in the center of our lives. And you can't do that if you're cultivating the desire, I'll be a big shot. Because as I've said, you have to give your time, your energy, your thoughts, everything to that.
Yes, I was under the impression that with a spiritual goal, you can, with a spiritual goal, and a spiritual aim, you may have to do these material activities. With a spiritual goal, that
yes, that's true, but you have to see how strong your goal is. How strong is your motivation? It's not that you say, oh, you can do, I'll do everything, I'll act like a complete materialist and have a spiritual goal. But it doesn't work like that. Spiritual, if we actually have a spiritual goal, then the symptom of that is that we will want to maximize our time for hearing and chanting. Practically speaking, if we are in material life, then it takes up most of our time. Especially in the modern age, you have to work and you have to do so. It takes up most of your time, so you don't have much time for hearing and chanting. So instead of thinking that it's all right to spend 14 hours a day working and then there's, you know, maybe 1.5 hours left to try and cram in a little sadhana here and there, rather we should try to organize our lives in such a way that we have more time for hearing and chanting. Rather than if we think I'll be a material success, what you're practically saying is that I already have the spiritual goal, and now I'm going to minimize my spiritual life so I can increase my material situation so I can preach. But it's a kind of self-deception, because where is the spiritual life? Spiritual life means more hearing and chanting about Krishna. So it's not that you can just be like any normal materialist and squeeze in a few Hare Krishnas here and there, and when in between, you know, running around here and there, and at the same time you're thinking of how I can make more money and be more prestigious, and that's Krishna consciousness. That is not Krishna consciousness. That is a mundane interpretation of Krishna consciousness. Yeah, give the mic. So, this idea that you should increase materially, but it means that unless you're actually very pure, then the more you'll forget Krishna in the midst of more and more material activities and by associating with people like that. And if you are more pure, you won't want to do that anyway. You might be in that situation, like we say, by your destiny. There are some people who are like that. It's just like we always used to hear in the Western countries, devotees would say that, well, we're going to form a rock band, and then we'll become famous, and it'll be good for preaching. But actually, they just want to play rock music, and they don't become famous, and they just become interested more and more in rock music. They should have stuck to doing kirtan. So this idea that I'll become a material success, and then people will take notice of me, and then they'll become devotees. But I'll use that for preaching. Well, if your actual motive is to preach, it's much better to focus fully on being a pure devotee, and people will notice that, because pure devotees are unusual in this world. Material successes, there are millions of them. So many successes die every day.
What I wanted to ask is, Arjuna was a pure devotee, but first he spent his life gathering all the weapons and becoming a Kshatriya. So we say that was his dharma, to accumulate all the knowledge and everything. Our dharma is not to study and all.
Not in exactly the same way, because that was a dharmic society in which, of course, it was the dharma side was being broken down, and that's why Arjuna had to fight. But basically the culture was there. Vanashram acharavata purushena purapraman vishnur aradhyate panta nanyat tatto shakaranam. The culture was there that one should perform vanashram duties centered on worship of Vishnu. Vedic society is based on yajna. Everything that everyone does, or everyone's work, becomes consummated in yajna for the satisfaction of Vishnu. That's not there in the modern age. Everything is centered on personal sense enjoyment. So it's not exactly the same. Practically speaking, there is no dharma in the sense that there is in Varnashram society. It's not, when we say, what is your dharma of a student? It doesn't work in the same way that it used to, because society is not organized according to dharmic principles. It's organized according to adharmic principles. The society is organized on the principle that everyone should live for sense gratification.
Just one question. In case material opulence is
entrusted, please just speak in the mic.
In case material opulence is thrust on us because of our destiny, are we supposed to reject it or use it in business?
No, use it. If you by your destiny you have opulence, use it for Krishna's service. You may reject it or you may use it. It depends. Bharat Maharaj rejected it. But you may use it. If one is not bewildered by it, one may use it. But it's dangerous, because the tendency is of the conditioned soul is to try to enjoy it.
But the conscious endeavor has not been made for material opulence.
No, an endeavor has to be for spiritual opulence. That means for serving Krishna. Otherwise, bhogaishvarya prasaktanam tayaparita chetasam. Persons who are attached to material enjoyment and opulence, their intelligence becomes bewildered. And then they cannot fix their mind in samadhi on Krishna consciousness. So that's why it's very dangerous. You may say, I'm going to concentrate on becoming a material success and a big shot. But the tendency is to become attracted to the goals which everyone else is doing that for, which is material enjoyment and prestige. You become attached to that. And then you lose Krishna consciousness, which is much more precious. So better protect your Krishna consciousness. Ultimately, it doesn't matter whether you're a big shot or not. It doesn't matter in the slightest bit. At the time of death, we have to remember Krishna. So we should organize our lives in such a way that is most favorable for remembering Krishna at the time of death. Everything should be centered on that. And if you have material desires, well, at least recognize them. At least admit it. Instead of saying, I'm pursuing a career. It's all for preaching. You could use it like that, maybe. But then, if your goal is mixed, then your preaching will also be mixed. Unless you're a pure devotee, unless your motivation is pure, you cannot inspire others in pure devotional service. You can inspire them in mixed devotional service. But mixed devotional service is not slightly as valuable as pure devotional service. Because it means that we want to, it's contradictory, we want to serve Krishna and at the same time enjoy this material world. Alright, seems like the questions died out. So, we won't die out. We'll go on living forever in Krishna consciousness. But we may finish this program here. Hare Krishna, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Bless, what do you want blessing for? Yeah, this is, but the blessing comes by instruction. That's blessing. It's not, well, that I'm doing. On Prabhupada's also order, I'm also writing books which are giving instructions. For those who are confused, as most people in the world are,